Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Heather Booth, Director of Americans for Financial Reform, who talks about her group's campaign to demand Congress enact legislation to strictly regulate U.S. banks and financial institutions. Janet Keating of the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, who condemns the Obama administration's decision to issue a permit for mountaintop removal coal mining in West Virginia. And Annie Shattuck of Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy, who talks about a recent government report which found a record increase in hunger in America. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a move blasted by human rights groups, Thailand has forcibly deported 4,500 ethnic Hmong refugees back to Laos. The United Nations and the Obama administration criticized the mass deportation of the Hmong who aided the American military during the Vietnam War and now fear persecution from the communist-led Laotian government. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the mass deportation took place in late December from a military-run camp in northern Thailand. The Hmong refugees were put in trucks and driven across the border to Laos and handed over to government authorities. Ethnic Hmong returnees feel vulnerable since Hmong insurgents are still fighting the Laotian government in remote mountainous areas. Many of the Hmong had sought formal refugee status out of fear of persecution in Laos. But this fact was ignored by Thai authorities who have never signed the 1951 United Nations Convention on Refugees. In the past, Thai officials have been accused of mistreating people along the border who were fleeing the brutal military junta in Myanmar, formerly known as Burma. A separate group of 158 ethnic Hmong who were given UN refugee status were also deported to Laos. The United States and other countries have agreed to resettle these refugees, with the Laotian government agreeing to cooperate. State environmental inspectors have become overwhelmed monitoring a surge in natural gas drilling, as reported by the investigative news service ProPublica. With advances in new technology like hydraulic fracturing, estimates of known natural gas reserves in the United States have risen 35% since 2007. Existing reserves of natural gas are expected to satisfy energy demand for the next 100 years. Increasing new drilling has also raised a number of environmental concerns, especially along the Marcellus Shale, which stretches from West Virginia, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and upstate New York. Not enough inspectors have been hired to keep track of the expanded drilling activity. Jim Baca, who worked in the Clinton administration for the Federal Bureau of Land Management, remarked, "Not having eyeballs on the ground is horrendous. If you don't enforce the law, the industry will do whatever they think they can get away with." In Texas, the state with the most oil and gas wells, each inspector is responsible for 3,300 wells. A 2007 report by the Texas Auditor found half of the state wells had not been inspected between 2001 and 2006. The Texas Railroad Commission, which oversees the inspections, says it is not possible to inspect each well every year with current resources. Growing numbers of renters in major cities like New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles have become the latest victims of the mortgage crisis. The foreclosure wave has now reached thousands of multifamily housing complexes owned by real estate speculators, resulting in deteriorating living conditions. A year ago, Ocelot Capital Group defaulted on a series of rental buildings in the Bronx, which were cited for thousands of Class C housing code violations. New York courts have now appointed a receiver to manage the housing complexes. Housing conditions became more dangerous, with vandals breaking into buildings and plumbing yanked out and sold as scrap metal. According to the Washington Post, the foreclosure of multi-unit rental buildings has skyrocketed in the last year. In the Washington, D.C. area alone, 475 multifamily rental complexes were foreclosed in the first 9 months of 2009, exceeding the entire number for 2008. A study by Deutsche Bank found loan performance for multifamily rental buildings was declining at a rapid rate. An estimated 65% to 75% of owners of multifamily buildings would not qualify for refinancing at current mortgage rates. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon, For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
One year after the financial meltdown that ushered in the worst U.S. recession since the Great Depression, the Obama administration and Congress are working toward passage of legislation to improve new regulations on the nation's banks and financial institutions. On December 11th, Democrats in the House passed a bill, without a single Republican vote, that would create a new federal agency to protect consumers by policing the practices of mortgage and credit card companies and establish new rules for the trading of derivatives and increase transparency of the credit rating process. The legislation also authorizes an audit of the Federal Reserve and requires the nation's large banks to pay into a fund that would be used to break them up and sell them off if they go bankrupt. The Senate is now working on its own financial reform bill with the possibility of attracting bipartisan support. But some observers say the proposed new regulations don't go far enough to prevent big banks and Wall Street from engaging in casino-like behavior that could cause another devastating economic collapse. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Heather Booth, a longtime social justice organizer and director of Americans for Financial Reform, who talks about her group's campaign to demand Congress enact strict new rules to rein in the reckless conduct of U.S. banks and financial institutions.
Real financial reform could protect working families and small businesses and rein in this greedy and reckless behavior of the big banks and Wall Street that's cost millions of jobs. We could crack down on the kinds of abuses committed by credit card companies and mortgage lending industry. And so these are the kinds of reforms that we're fighting for to strengthen both the financial system, prevent another financial crisis, and really improve our lives. But it will only happen if people organize. So we created this organization, Americans for Financial Reform. We have over 250 national, state, and local organizations, ranging from pension funds and investors and unions, consumer advocate organizations, civil rights groups, USPIRG, Consumer Federation. So there's a whole array of groups.
Heather, tell us sort of where things stand with the House and Senate.
Right. There's a bill that made its way through the House Financial Services Committee, and it made a first step towards reform. And they're elements that really can be built on. Amongst those elements are, and these are the key things to keep your eye on as this legislation moves through. One is a Consumer Financial Protection Agency. This is an agency that really will crack down on the credit card abuses and the mortgage and predatory lenders and ensure that there's someone looking out for the consumer and not just controlled by the largest banks. The second big element is this systemic risk. Who's looking out for the overall economy? Who's looking at these institutions that are too big to fail? Whatever's the entity to control, to look out for the overall economy and control those institutions, our main concern is that it not be controlled by the largest banks. The third big area is what we call the shadow markets, the derivatives. And these are the risky trades, the casino investment with our money that's made on just betting on one thing after another, often actually without any money really to back it up. And we don't really know what's going on with that world because it is not transparent. It's not open. We don't know what's being traded. And we don't know what capital is there to back it up. And so this trading, we want to see that it's traded on exchanges or that it's cleared and the information is publicly reported. So the bill was going through the House. It addressed all of these elements on consumer protection. There is a strong independent consumer protection agency that's in the House bill. There were some exemptions and loopholes that were identified that we hope can be strengthened on the Senate side. On the too-big-to-fail institutions, it was very modest what was proposed, and there's still great authority allowed for the Federal Reserve, which really is control. The Board of Governors are elected by the largest banks. And then on derivatives and shadow markets, some would come under control, but they're enormous loopholes. You can trade on a foreign exchange, and then that's an exemption. If there are trades between the big banks, they can go through a so-called swap execution facility, and that could even be a telephone. If you make a telephone deal, maybe that's excluded. And so there are some exemptions. We hope that gets fixed as it moves to the Senate side.
Heather, how much money are the financial firms, the big financial firms in the country, spending to influence the outcome of this reform effort? And how successful have they been in weakening it to the point where it won't really change the system that brought us this economic collapse last year?
Oh, Scott, you're raising the central questions. The financial services industry spent $344 million lobbying against reform in the first three quarters of 2009, and that's reported from Newsweek. They have more than 1,500 lobbyists registered with Congress to work on these new rules. Again, that's reported from Forbes. I'm not making up these figures. And at least 70 former members of Congress were employed by the financial services industry, and nearly half of all former members reported that they were lobbying in 2009. So just some of the kinds of people who are doing the lobbying. It's former Speaker of the House Dennis Hastert from Illinois, former Senate Majority Leader and Republican presidential nominee Bob Dole, former Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott. You just go down the list. So it's a revolving door. First they serve in Congress, then they serve more directly at the service of these banks. And just one last thing about the kind of domination they've had. House Republican leaders met with more than 100 lobbyists at a pep rally in December to fight back financial reform. And the lobbyists were basically saying, look, you're not doing enough to fight financial reform. With Americans for Financial Reform, we need your help. It's only if people organize that will really make a difference. But if we organize, we can counter all that money and influence and power and concentration if we organize.
That was Heather Booth, Director of Americans for Financial Reform. Contact the group by calling area code 202-263-4533 or visit their website at ourfinancialsecurity.org. In early January, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency approved the first mountaintop removal coal mining permit in West Virginia, among the 23 in the state it had delayed for further scrutiny. The EPA issued a permit to the Patriot Coal Corporation's Hobet 45 mine with the condition that the company reduce by half the number of miles of streams buried. Throughout Appalachia, the EPA has held 79 permits for a more thorough review, a departure from the Bush administration's practice of rubber stamping virtually all such applications from coal companies. On January 8th, a panel of experts published a report in Science magazine about the health and environmental impacts of mountaintop removal, the first such study ever undertaken. The report's 12 environmental scientists concluded that the evidence that mountaintop removal coal mining destroys streams and threatens human health is so strong that the government should stop granting new permits for it. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Janet Keating, executive director of the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, one of the grassroots groups in West Virginia fighting to stop mountaintop removal mining, which destroys mountains, pollutes streams, and spreads air contamination by blasting tons of rocks with millions of pounds of dynamite. She explains why her group condemns the EPA decision to grant the permit to the Hobet mine and how opponents hope to end the destructive mining practice.
We hope it's not a trend. This is a massive permit. We're talking 25 square miles. So the company apparently plans to truck some of the waste off of the site and put it in other areas where they've already mined, other valley fills, I assume, and somehow they're only going to be covering half the 6 miles that had originally been planned to be covered. So we're having 3 miles of streams covered, and somehow magically none of the selenium that's in the waste is going to get into the streams now. They're going to somehow route or engineer this mine so that they will avoid the streams that are already there, any of the runoff. And in fact, they're planning to put some of the waste back on top of the site. I just think it's junk. I think what really happened at the Hobet site, it's a political deal. This is by far, I think, one of the largest union mines. There are very few union mines left. I think the politicians were pressured by the union, and EPA was pressured by the politicians, and this particular permit got issued. And even if they're able to avoid, you know, the mining through half the streams, that doesn't really give much solace to the people that are living with the impacts of the mining, the dust, the explosions, the health issues that occur as a result of being exposed to the dust, the water that gets despoiled in the long run. So it's still mountains. The ancient mountains are still getting blown to bits.
Well, besides restricting the number of miles of streams that can be buried from 6 down to 3, the EPA added other restrictions to the permit that are supposed to protect water quality.
You know, I honestly don't trust that, and the reason why is we have, you know, here our state agency is certainly, if they're going to be the ones to enforce any monitoring, you know, once violations may be found, and I suspect they will be, what are they going to do about it? Because, you know, for example, earlier this year, the EPA stepped in and had to sue Massey Energy for more than 4,500 violations of the Clean Water Act because the state wasn't doing anything, period. The state missed out on any fines, and maybe it's not necessarily the fault of the state. Maybe they don't have adequate personnel. I know there are 90 vacancies in DEP, but nevertheless, we don't take a lot of solace that they're going to monitor more.
Janet Keating, the day after the EPA issued the Hobet mine permit, the first ever peer-reviewed study of the impacts of mountaintop removal was published in Science magazine, which is about the most prestigious magazine in the field. It's a long time coming, but then the authors finished with a call to end the practice. What do you think of the study?
They're saying that there's plenty of evidence that mountaintop removal is causing irreversible harm to the watersheds and affecting people's health. How do you get around that at this point? How does anybody issue another permit? The Obama administration has said, you know, early on that they would be making decisions in general, that their EPA would be making decisions based on sound science. And I guess our point of view would be that if that is indeed true, then future permits or permits are still in the, I guess it would be about 22 permits, they won't be issued at all, not for mountaintop removal. You know, and we're not saying don't mine the coal. We're saying don't mine the coal that way.
When I was in West Virginia, I met some people who are just against mountaintop removal but support underground mining, and then others who were saying we just have to leave the coal in the ground, both because of coal's impact on the communities there and also because of its heavy carbon footprint, which causes climate change.
Well, you know, I think that it's unrealistic to say stop all coal mining here because 98% of West Virginia's electricity comes from coal mining. You know, what would we do in the interim? So I think there has to be a transition, and I truly believe that's going to be really important. I think a transition would actually provide more jobs. You know, if we can transition to renewable energy here, you know, retool some of our old industrial facilities that have shut down.
After the Hobet mine permit was granted, anti-mountaintop removal forces urged supporters to contact the EPA and call for an end to mountaintop removal, and apparently the EPA's phone lines were jammed with people doing just that.
I quite honestly believe it's going to be the people across the country that are going to help us stop this. We can't do it alone. The politics are just too corrupt here, and it's going to take a nation to help us.
That was Janet Keating of the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition. Contact the group by calling area code 304-522-0246 or visit their website at ohvec.org. A report released by the U.S. Department of Agriculture in mid-November found that the number of Americans who lack food is at the highest level ever recorded, with nearly 50 million people experiencing hunger last year, including one of out of every four children without enough to eat. The report found that 16%, or 49 million Americans in all age groups, ran short of nutritious food during the course of the year, compared with about 12% the year before. The effect of the nation's economic crisis is clearly seen in the report's findings, connecting rising poverty and record levels of unemployment with people's inability to feed themselves and their children. During his campaign for the presidency, Barack Obama pledged to end childhood hunger. Now, with record levels of hunger, anti-poverty groups are pressing the White House to make good on that promise. During the past three decades, over 100 local food policy councils have been established across the U.S. These councils create community space for discussion of food issues and platforms for coordinated action addressing food supply, quality, pricing, production, distribution, and consumption. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Annie Shattuck, policy analyst with the group Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy. Shattuck, co-author of Food First's report, Food Policy Councils, Lessons Learned, talks about the government's report on growing hunger in America and the role food councils could play in alleviating that hunger.
It's an absolutely unacceptable situation. And what most people in this country don't realize is the rate of food insecurity, which in the lexicon of the experts means that at some point in the year, you don't know where your next meal is coming from. You have a hard time getting enough food. Maybe you're skipping meals so that your kids have enough to eat. Doesn't necessarily mean you're outright starving or malnourished. That's this idea of food insecurity. So we're looking at 1 in 7 Americans with food insecure, and that actually tracks almost exactly the number of people who are food insecure worldwide, which is about 1 in 6. We got 1 billion food insecure people on the planet right now, which is the most we've ever had. So if we say America's turning into the rest of the world in this regard, it's absolutely true. Now, that USDA report, they started keeping track in the mid-90s, so it's probably not the hungriest this country has ever been, but it's really bad. And we have more people on food stamps now than we've ever had before, and some 70% of them are actually working. The food stamp program used to be a stopgap for people who are unemployed or lost their job or needed a few months of benefits to make ends meet. But now we're actually seeing things getting so bad for people who actually have jobs that food stamps are supplementing poor wages. So in terms of a hunger situation in this country, we're looking at a pretty critical time.
Tell us about food policy councils and how they can be a tool to address the hunger issue in various places around the country, encountering various and in different circumstances and in an environment.
Well, it's nice to actually be the bearer of some good news in this field, and that is that state and local governments have a lot that they can do, and there's a lot that community groups can do, not just to deal with hunger, food insecurity or diet-related disease, but environmental effects of industrial agriculture and loss of farmland and the bottoming out of the farm economy. And that's what food policy councils really set out to do, is take all of these problems from a systemic level and say, what is going on in our local area and what leverage do we have as a city or as a county to do something about it? So a food policy council is an advisory board to either a state or local government entity that brings together people from every part of the food system, from waste management to food processing, local business retailers, the health department, transit, social services, maybe the food bank, community groups, nonprofit organizations, and they really try to sit down and connect the dots. So some food policy councils play a role of coordinating. They say, oh, the Farm Bureau has excess produce. The food bank needs it. We can send trucks out on the return from their delivery. And we're really just providing a platform for people to better coordinate their efforts. And other councils actually sit down and say, okay, what can we do in terms of city policy? Let's change our school food purchasing so we buy from local farmers. Let's look at routing buses so there's better access to full-service healthy food groceries from low-income neighborhoods. And then other councils actually spin off entirely new programs or even whole organizations sometimes that address a specific local need. So one of the things we did in this project was there's over 100 food policy councils around the country, coast to coast. It's not a West Coast or a Northeast innovation. They're pretty equally spread around the country. And said we interviewed 50 councils and said, you know, what are you doing, what works, and what have the challenges been? And across the board, throughout the country, everything food policy councils are doing is tailored to a specific local situation. There's nothing that's been an across-the-board success, but there are scores of success stories from each council.
Now, President Obama, when he was running for president, pledged to end child hunger. What has his administration done in the first year of his presidency to address that issue, and what needs to be done now?
Well, I would say the jury is still out. The Obama administration has made some tremendous strides. The Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food program in the USDA is showing sort of a more progressive view, a holistic view, a systemic view of some of these food policy issues. Secretary Vilsack himself is a huge supporter of food policy councils, and there's been some rumors that they may or may not be supporting this more explicitly. And then really getting some funding, some stimulus funding, permanent funding into the food stamps program and into childhood nutrition. One of the big fights coming up is to get the school lunch rate reimbursement rate increased so that schools can actually afford to feed kids good food. Right now, after you pay labor and heating up the food and getting it there on the truck, schools in California have maybe a dollar to spend on the actual food. So those are some of the big issues, and we have yet to see.
That was Annie Shattuck, policy analyst with the group Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy. The Food First Report, Food Policy Councils, Lessons Learned, can be read online at the group's website, foodfirst.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced in association with WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Todd. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.